these upcoming generations seem different. You know, they strive for work-life balance. They seem to have other things that interest them beyond money. I'm not saying that we're just purely interested in money, but money mattered to us, right? It was the 1980s, greed is good, and all those kinds of things, right? The movie Wall Street, Michael Douglas, all that. That was the culture in which we were raised.
We are back with another episode of Future Proof. Happy Monday. If there is such a thing, of course there's such a thing. It's all about your mindset, right? It's all about just getting into the right frame of mind. So think good thoughts and let's get this thing rolling, shall we? This is episode number 149, by the way. I'm Bill Sheridan. I've been here for all of them. Perfect attendance, right? Unblemished record. The streak lives on. I'm like the DiMaggio of podcasts, I guess. And I don't even know what that means, but let's get this thing started with this, shall we? This week's show is sponsored by the Business Learning Institute, which delivers competency-based curriculum, courses, content, and community to maximize career trajectories and grow intellectual capital for organizational and executive leadership. Hundreds of courses by dozens of instructors and unlimited customization. Find out how the Business Learning Institute can help you by visiting blionline.org. All right. All right, we're going to talk about the economy, and it's actually going to be interesting. And here's why. It's all due to my guest this week. He is Anibon Basu. Anibon is chairman and CEO of Sage Policy Group, an economic and policy consulting firm headquartered in the great city of Baltimore, which is in the great state of Maryland. He's one of the most popular speakers on the MACPA's educational circuit, without a doubt. One of the most popular. CPAs love this guy. He's chair of the Maryland Economic Development Commission and of the Baltimore County Economic Advisory Committee, one of Maryland's 50 most influential people, yada, yada, yada. I mean, when it comes to the economy, this guy has major cred, and he is with us this week. This is going to be a good one, folks. But before we get to that interview, here's what caught my eye this week. It's an article from Reuters. It's titled Global Growth to Stay Strong, but Virus is the Top Risk, written by reporter Shruti Sarkar. And it says in part, quote, here's what he writes. Global economic growth prospects are holding strong for this year and next, despite a significant majority of economists in Reuters polls warning that new variants of the coronavirus pose the biggest risk to that outlook. A global survey of nearly 500 economists taken this month also concluded recent rising inflation in key economies around the world would be transitory. The global economy was now forecast to expand a sizzling 6.0% this year, which would be its fastest in nearly half a century, followed by a still robust 4.5% in 2022. Both were marginal increases from the April poll. Slightly more than half of the 48 economies polled on each quarter were upgraded for both years, but a surge in the latest variants of the virus is a reminder that vaccinations may have improved, but the pandemic has not gone away. Quote, in recent weeks, financial markets have caught up to the idea that the COVID crisis is not entirely over. The Delta variant adds to the challenge, raising the number of cases and the threshold for herd immunity, said Ethan Harris, global economist at Bank of America Securities. He went on to say, quote, overall, we see the Delta surge as a moderate headwind to global growth, but as new information comes in, we can be persuaded otherwise, end quote. So, there are a lot of variables, right, when it comes to our economic forecasts, lots of complexities to take into account. In other words, what the hell else is new, right? And of course, the biggest variable of all right now is COVID, and who knows how that's going to play out. But in the meantime, there are some things we can be certain of, or at least curious of. Things like the commercial real estate market, right? What are all these companies going to do with all their office space in this work-from-home environment? And other things like the residential housing market. Is this movement a bubble or what? And, you know, what should we be paying attention to going forward when it comes to our economy, right? Because there's just a lot of factors at play nowadays. So here we go. Quick look at the economy. Maryland United States, the COVID factor, housing, all of it. Let's get busy. And here to help us do that and make sense of all this stuff is none other than Anibon Basu himself. Buckle up, friends. This is going to be a great conversation. Here is my talk with Anibon Basu. So Anibon, I'm kind of curious, how has Sage Policy Group weathered the pandemic so far, economically or otherwise?
Yeah, we're hanging in there. We still haven't missed payroll. Made it last Friday, as it turns out. So, you know, about a year ago, a little bit more than a year ago now, you know, when the economy was falling apart in March and April, one of the things that we do a lot of is public speak. You know, I give presentations around the country and sometimes even out of the country, and all of those were canceled. Yeah. And I remember being at my home and wondering if any of them would be canceled. I mean, when's that going to start? And, you know, will it be 5 speeches, 7 speeches? Will it be 1 or 2 months of speeches? You know, 14 or 15 months later, you know, with limited exception, all of them were canceled. All of my in-person appearances were canceled, obviously, because of COVID-19. Right. So have we survived? Webinars, yeah. Zoom, yeah. You know, Microsoft Teams, Cisco WebEx. And that's, you know, really been our salvation from a public speaking perspective. Is we've really done an incredible number of webinars and survived as a result. We would have survived anyway, but as owner of the business, I would have had to dig into my own pocket to make things work. And that's not why I started the business. I didn't start the business to become really, really poor. I'm not really, really rich either. I'm an economist, so there's a limited upside here. But anyway, we're doing fine. Here we are. We made payroll. We have another 2 weeks at least to go.
There you go. All right. Well, I'm kind of curious, when the pandemic first hit, there seemed to be all kinds of like dire predictions about the economic crash that was coming and how long it was going to last and how bad things were going to get. And, you know, certainly if you lost a job or a loved one, God forbid, over the past year, things were as bad as they come. But I guess I'm curious what you think in general. How have we fared? And by we, I guess I'm talking about the United States here. How have we fared so far during the worst of the pandemic?
Yeah, for a lot of families, it's true, they've fared reasonably well. A lot of people didn't lose their jobs because they were able to work remotely. Obviously, there were plentiful stimulus payments made by the federal government during this period, stepped up unemployment insurance payments, you know, so, and the stock market has done very well. The housing market has raged higher in terms of sales price, for instance. And so there have been key parts of the economy that have probably improved over the course of the pandemic, housing being one of them. But let's not forget that in March and April of 2020, this nation lost 22 million jobs, that unemployment by April of 2020 was 14.7%, 16.1% for women, that since February of 2020, which is the last pre-pandemic crisis month in America, the labor force has shrunk by 3.5 million people, meaning that many people are neither working or looking for work, they're disengaged, that a lot of children have suffered educationally because they haven't had broadband, they haven't been able to learn effectively remotely. And so what has happened here seems to be that whatever the disparities were coming into this crisis, they're much, much worse now. And one hopes that as this economy comes back to life, and it has been coming back to life, but even more so over the course of the balance of 2021, that some of these disparities will start moving in the right direction, meaning that we'll start to close some of these socioeconomic disparities or educational disparities. But you know, we shall see. But yeah, in many ways, many people in the broader economy probably held up better than many people could have possibly predicted, given that we're in this now 14 or 15 months.
Yeah. Yeah. And now, you know, I don't even know if this is true. People keep saying we're coming out of the pandemic now. And, you know, who knows at this point, but at least as things are starting to reopen here at home a little bit at a time, how are things looking short term to you economically as we start to kind of crawl our way out of the crisis?
Yeah, so just when you thought it was safe to get back in the water, a new set of challenges is emerging for the economy. And this time it relates to shortages. Shortages of what? Materials. So many people probably have heard about the surge in softwood lumber prices experienced recently. Oil prices are back up towards $70 a barrel in much of the world. We see shortages of chlorine, in even Chick-fil-A sauce, which is a real crisis, of course, right? You only get one packet. That's not enough. So there's that. Then, of course, many employers are complaining about the fact that they can't secure enough workers. So during the final day of March, there were 8.1 million available unfilled jobs in America. That was an all-time record. And yet the following month, we only added 266,000 jobs, according to a preliminary estimate from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Why? If you have so many job openings, why can't you create more jobs? Because there's not enough workers out there to fill those jobs, not even close. And a lot of people are reluctant or unable to re-engage the labor market for a variety of reasons, stepped up unemployment insurance benefits, lingering fears of infection and or vaccination, and of course, the fact that many kids are still learning remotely. So a lot of things have people, parents and others, disengaged from the labor market. And that means that over the course of the summer, a lot of businesses, hotels, restaurants, retailers, others, will be scrambling for talent as they meet this tsunami of demand. My expectation is that in September, this economy really comes back to life. Why? By that point, the stepped up unemployment insurance benefits would have lapsed around the country. They've lapsed some places already because governors have made that decision not to accept those federal supplements to unemployment insurance. And also because once kids start learning in person, a lot of parents will be freed up, moms and dads, to re-enter the labor force. And then you'll see this economy really come back to life. But the next few months are going to be associated with maybe a sputtering recovery in terms of the labor market because we just have too many job openings and not enough people to fill them.
Yeah, yeah. So good news short term. Looking a little further down the road, beyond September and even further, what are things looking like for you a little longer term?
Yeah, that becomes more problematic because we know that we have this, what I'll call post-pandemic euphoria. We're not necessarily purely in a post-pandemic world, but we're getting there. You can see, people at Yankees games and Knicks games and maybe even Orioles games, enjoying a game without wearing a mask and those kinds of things. So normalcy is starting to reemerge. But at some point in the future, one can imagine an American economy that's associated with faltering stimulus, higher interest rates, more inflation, more massive national debt, and of course, more political wrangling. That's a given. And so you put all that together, there might be a period during which the U.S. economy doesn't look so good for structural reasons, not because of a pandemic or some kind of other shorter-term phenomenon, because structurally we've taken on so much debt, we have low labor force participation, we've suffered some setbacks educationally, and we might see fit to raise taxes and do other things that could soften the pace of economic expansion.
How much of that kind of stuff is cyclical or is it? I'm just kind of curious.
Yeah, what I'm talking about is mostly structural, right? So the national debt has emerged, for instance, over many, many years. Particularly over the last 20 years or so, mm-hmm. We've seen this national debt really climb. That's not so much cyclical, it's structural. The issue regarding low labor force participation rates is structural, it's not cyclical. But yes, of course, there are business cycles. And every once in a while, the economy becomes irrationally exuberant. Late 1990s, the housing market of the 2000s, and then there's a cleansing, yeah, where these markets re-equilibrate, lots of people lose their jobs, a lot of speculative excess is washed out of the system, a lot of money disappears, it dries up, and then we get back on our feet again as an economy, as we did, let's say, back in 2009 or 2001, and we start moving forward. So yes, it's cyclical, but right now, a lot of the things that affect America, and therefore my outlook, are structural in nature.
Yeah. Little harder to solve those types of things, having a bigger impact longer term. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, that's right. So it's the confluence of demographics, technology, social norms, and of course, public policy. These structural factors will define ultimately, where a nation will head. There was a time when there was a British Empire and the sun never set on the British Empire. It wasn't that a business cycle took down the British Empire. It was structural phenomena.
Right.
A far-flung empire, lots of wars, lots of national debt, so on and so forth. And of course, the aspirations of colonized people, all of those things brought down the British Empire, but structural factors, not cyclical ones. And we have some major structural issues in this country. Our broken infrastructure, for instance, is just one of them. And we don't seem to have been able to deal with that kind of issue properly yet.
Yeah. Yeah. Shifting gears here real briefly, I'm curious your thoughts on what employers in this profession, so we're talking accounting, finance, those types of things. Employers in this profession, what should they be keeping in mind at this point as their, talent, the search for talent is huge in this profession, as it is, in many others, but what should employers kind of be keeping in mind as they're trying to fill those holes and recruit new employees in this environment?
Yeah, the realities of Generation Y and Generation Z, they are different. They're different in their expectations. They're different in terms of their objectives. So I'm a member of Generation X, also known as the Baby Bust Generation, born between 65 and 79 or 65 and 80, depending on how one defines the generation. And, you know, what were we about? I think we're largely about money.
Yeah.
Right? If you wanted us to work on the weekends, pay us to work on the weekends. We'd be there. Right? You want us to work until 8 p.m.? No problem. Just pay us. Not a big deal. These upcoming generations seem different. You know, they strive for work-life balance. They seem to have other things that interest them beyond money. I'm not saying that we're just purely interested in money, but money mattered to us, right? It was the 1980s, greed is good, and all those kinds of things, right? The movie Wall Street, Michael Douglas, all that. That was the culture in which we were raised. These young people, some of them care about money, of course. It's a large generation. For instance, Generation Y is a very large generation, the millennials, but they have different expectations. And now that they know that they have an opportunity to work from home, in many cases, aren't they going to demand that from their employers? I think they will. And so, unfortunately, a lot of us older employers are going to have to come face-to-face with millennial and Generation Z expectations. Generation Z is now the youngest members of the workforce. And that's challenging because we're used to getting into work at 9, staying till 5, being in the office, going to the office Christmas party. This generation is totally different. If they can get the work done at home, they're asking the question, why can't I just be at home? It's where I want to be. And so, employers and recruiters are going to have to deal with these realities, and it's going to be challenging.
Seems like there's more cultural factors at play today than there ever have been in the workforce for some reason.
Well, I think it's because we share so much, right? So social media makes people aware of what's going on all over the world. And there are stories about, you know, how Google is handling its workforce or how other companies are. And when people say, well, look, you know, Google has snacks all over the place. You know, they have their own cafeteria. Why don't we have that?
Right.
And the answer is because Google is Google and only Google is Google. The rest of us are not Google for the most part, unless we're Apple. So, you know, the point is the expectations have been raised, I think. And part of that is social media. The fact that we have a 24/7 news cycle, that we're aware of the possibilities of the world in a way that we weren't when many of us were growing up. When I was growing up, it was basically, I remember on Saturdays or Sundays seeing Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. And that was my exposure to people who lived differently from me. But it was so rarefied, I didn't really care. But now, of course, you know, people are living large and people are posting the fact that they're living large, or at least perceived to be living large, on social media all the time. And other people aspire to that level of flexibility, that level of compensation, that level of fame. And so in any case, young people have high expectations, and we older people who employ them have to deal with that.
Let's talk a little real estate here for just a couple of minutes. I'm interested in two factors. Commercial first, what I'm hearing anyway, hybrid work from home, all those things are starting to dig in. So I'm wondering if you could speak to what you think this market is going to look like going forward in this new kind of environment that's taking shape right now coming out of the pandemic.
Yeah, there might be a temptation among some to think, well, this is temporary, right? So we went through a 14 or 15 month pandemic and steadily we'll return to where we had been. But there sometimes are things that cause permanent or near permanent changes in behavior. And so I'll give you an example. The advent of the American automobile permanently changed our lives, right? Gave birth to the suburbs. So technology can change things permanently. And things like Zoom and GoToWebinar and other platforms can change things permanently. The fact that we've learned that many people are more productive or as productive working from home as in the office. The fact that we've learned that many people are more delighted to work from home than in the office, want to work from home, are happier working from home, matters. And none of that inures to the benefit of commercial real estate. So I think that commercial real estate has been permanently impaired. That's certainly true for new office construction. That's true for hotels that cater to business travelers. You know, often those hotels have major conference and convention spaces. But now that we can have meetings on Zoom and GoToWebinar, how rapidly will that segment come back? And then, of course, because so much of our shopping was done online during the pandemic, and now we are used to buying groceries on Instacart. If you didn't have an Amazon account before, you probably have one now, right? I mean, you've been streaming Netflix for 14 months now. You know, you might not have been before, right? So all these things, I think, make life difficult from a commercial real estate perspective. because we can do so much from home. On the other hand, there have been certain segments that have really improved because of the pandemic. The demand for data centers is way up. So data center construction is booming. Mm-hmm. The demand for fulfillment centers, the backbone of the e-commerce economy, fulfillment center construction is up. So it depends on the segment. And I think also one of the places that you'll see a lot of investment in is healthcare capacity. Because mm-hmm. this pandemic laid bare the fact that we haven't invested enough in ICU beds and ventilators, and you need more space to house that kind of equipment, that kind of technology. And so in any case, some segments were hurt by the pandemic permanently, and some segments, I think, get a permanent bump because of the pandemic.
Do you think it's possible we might see a whole new reimagining or new industries themselves arise around this notion of, you know, what are we going to do with all this office space now that we are entering this kind of new era where we might not need as much as that's sitting out there? It just strikes me that there's a lot of opportunity maybe for someone who's really smart to come up with something new to do with all that space.
Oh, sure. We've been doing that for years. I mean, you remember that during the global financial crisis, a lot of office space became vacant. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of that was turned into apartment buildings, for instance. You see that in downtown Baltimore, for instance, but throughout the country, you know, a lot of these office buildings, historic, beautiful office buildings are now beautiful, historic apartment buildings. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you think about all the empty retail space in this country, not just office space, but, you know, a vacant shopping center space that could become data centers, affordable housing, last mile fulfillment centers, outpatient medical centers, outpatient surgical centers, lots of potential uses. And I think the communities that will do the best will have the greatest imagination with respect to how to adaptively reuse that vacant space. And really what it translates into is that somebody owns that vacant space, and communities have to motivate those folks, those owners, not to simply sit idly by as those properties deteriorate, but to actually actively reimagine them, what role they can play in the post-pandemic world, and to revive them, to adaptively reuse them, to bring them back on the tax rolls. And that's what communities should be focused on, among other things.
And the residential housing market. So I keep hearing talk about this, you know, this being decidedly different, right? This era that we're in right now and the boom that we're in, maybe lasting longer than the last times homes were moving this fast. This might be certainly, you know, home prices are rising and home sellers seem to, I don't know, it just seems to be their kind of market right now. But it, from what I'm hearing, this is different from like other housing bubbles. I mean, what are you seeing when it comes to residential housing right now?
Yeah, that's not a bubble. No. So, you know, what happened in 02, 03, 04, 05, 06 was that home prices, of course, rose very rapidly, which is true for the current period as well. But also while those home prices were rising, so too was supply of single family homes. You mm-hmm. know, so there was lots of speculation. Demand was artificially bolstered by no document loans, by loose lending standards, by interest only mortgages, so on and so forth. And so when the demand started to disappear, as capital started or credit started to dry up, we had all these unsold homes. And then, of course, on top of that, we had a foreclosure crisis, which brought even more homes to the market. So supply vastly outweighed demand, and so prices collapsed.
Yeah.
This time is different. Neighborhood by neighborhood by neighborhood, there's very little choice. The inventory of unsold homes is very low. And that's why any prospective buyer out there is facing bidding wars. You know, they have very limited choice. They have lots of competition for homes. And so often it's like an auction. So the supply-demand equilibrium is totally different from what it was, let's say, back in 05 or 06. It's much better for the sustainability of prices. Mm-hmm. Now, is it possible that prices will start to fall at some point, let's say next year? Yes. And what would cause that to happen? A meaningful increase in interest rates. But mm-hmm. that should not be interpreted as suggesting that a bubble is bursting. I don't think this is a speculative bubble. This is just supply and demand. Demand is bolstered in part by low mortgage rates. If those low mortgage rates disappear, then demand begins to fade just a bit. And so you might see prices start to come back to earth a bit. But it's not a bubble. Supply-demand equilibrium is in very good shape. We actually need more supply.
Okay. All right. So prices, they're high now. They may fall here and there, depending on interest rates, but we may not see a crash like we did back in the early aughts, so to speak.
That's exactly right. And there's another factor at work here, which is demographics. So the millennials are coming of age. So the oldest of the millennials will turn 40 this year, according to a conventional definition of that generation, born between 81 and 96 or 81 and 99. Definitions differ, but those are conventional definitions of that generation. The most common age in America this year is 29. So we know that a lot of folks are about to turn 30 in this country. And so 30-somethings often buy homes.
Yep.
20-somethings often rent apartments. So yep. During the previous decade, we saw a lot of apartments being built because the millennials were largely in their 20s. Now, over the next decade, they'll largely be in their 30s and into their 40s. And so they're going to be buying homes. So there's a demographic underpinning to this as well, which gives it more permanence.
Interesting. If there's one, I don't know what you call it, an X factor or a wild card in this entire conversation about the post-pandemic economy, what would it be? What should we be paying attention to?
I think the world politics, and the world economy. I mean, so one of the things that was happening prior to the pandemic was that global trade was faltering, right? That we saw a decline in foreign direct investment, so investments between various nations. We saw a decline in trade volumes between various nations. Some of that was triggered by trade wars, but there are broader factors at work. And so we have grown together as a world. And the post-World War II period has been a phenomenal one for this world, for this planet. We've brought billions of people out of poverty. And I think we've done it through freer trade and freer markets. But now there seems to be some rejection of freer trade and freer markets. And I think that's a mistake. That's what I learned in economics. And that's what I've observed as an economist over my decades of analyzing the global economy, not just the U.S. economy. And so I'm worried about that. You know, I want to see us continue to turn swords into plowshares, us to trade and therefore depend upon one another and be able to benefit one another simultaneously so that we have a mutual alignment of interests. But obviously, the world is a very dangerous place, lots of weapons of mass destruction and lots of tension in the Middle East and elsewhere. So that's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for peace and solidarity between human beings so that the world economy can continue to prosper and more people can come out of poverty.
As are we all. Boy, that would be great. Anibon Basu, thank you very much for your time, for your insights. I appreciate you being here. Thanks.
Anytime, Bill. Thank you.
All right, great stuff there from Anibon Basu. Anibon is chairman and CEO of Sage Policy Group. That's an economic and policy consulting firm headquartered in Baltimore. If you want to learn more, and you know you want to learn more, check out sagepolicy.com. Also, listen up. Anibon is going to be one of the featured speakers at the MACPA's 2021 Business and Industry Conference. That's Business and Industry Conference. Need to enunciate, right? It's going to be held October 29th. Save the date, both in person and virtual. You've got 8 hours of CPE ready for you. Get details and register at macpa.org. Good stuff awaits you there. And remember, this week's sponsor is the Business Learning Institute. The BLI's Future Ready Learning Framework outlines the skills that CPAs need to thrive in the rapidly changing world of accounting and finance. That framework is all about gaining and maintaining deep technical knowledge along with a strategic skill set. And here we're talking about strategic aptitudes that have been identified as most crucial for tomorrow's CPAs. Start mastering these future-ready skills now by visiting macpa.org/future-learning-framework. And that's it, gang. That's all I got. Have a great week. We'll talk to you again soon.